It's August 4th, 1693, and another remarkable event is about to be uncovered by Ariel, Rebecca, and Ollie, the Retrospectors.
So it was on this day that a Benedictine monk, whose name is now on one of the most highly regarded champagnes in the world, Dom Perignon, sampled his first ever sparkling and cried out to his fellow monks, "Brothers, come quickly, I am tasting the stars." Now, this whole story needs a heavy dose of, like, caveating and unpacking, because pretty much everyone agrees now that while the man and the drink are closely intertwined, this probably didn't happen, and it probably didn't happen on this particular date. So it's kind of developed this apocryphal myth that exists as a halo over the whole business of the construction of champagne. But he definitely was a monk, he definitely was involved in creating champagne, and he definitely was living in the region doing fun stuff with bubbles.
For one thing, he certainly wouldn't have been excited about tasting a sparkling wine, because at the time, if your wine ended up going sparkling, that was seen as a major fault, not least because they had much thinner glass in those days, and most of the time it would make the bottle explode. He dedicated his whole life to refining the technique of producing the wines that we now know as champagne. But ironically, the reason he devoted himself to that was to try and reduce the chances of getting these fizzy bottles.
Champagne is such an ever-present thing in our lives now. I don't mean that we live such a Bloomsbury existence.
I don't know what you're all drinking while you're listening to this podcast.
It's our only fluid. I just mean, when you attend a celebration, it is the default, that it seems hard to imagine that champagne was ever invented at all. You know, it's a bit like trying to attribute the discovery of barbecue or orange juice or something. It just seems like, surely people always knew that you could ferment wine a bit more and make it fizzy. But apparently not. I mean, it's quite recent, isn't it? Like, whoever invented it, it was like after Shakespeare was dead.
I mean, wine from the region of Champagne has been popular for absolutely ages, and they've been growing it since about the 5th century. The first viticulture was begun there by the Romans, but as Rebecca's saying, they were trying to get this imperfection out of the wine, the business of having bubbles in the bottle, because it turned them into these sort of explosive time bombs. And so particularly Dom Perignon, you know, his interest was more in kind of how to prune vines successfully and how to, you know, get the best out of the grape in ways to reduce the chance of the grapes being bruised and broken. And
I mean, he's doing his best, Rebecca, but I always feel when people talk about the origin and history of any kind of alcohol, like, it's so much less fun than drinking it. Do you know what I mean? This is why I don't do wine tastings. I've been a few times to wine tastings, and I always think it's going to be fun. And then you're like an hour into the first, you've had like a sip, you've had a thimble of wine, and someone's gone into grapes and vineyards and pressing, and I'm just like, there's a reason I don't work in that industry.
Well, if you'd gone to a wine tasting in Dom Perignon's time and you were sampling champagne, Ollie, you probably would be quite disappointed, because in this time period, the wines made in the Champagne region were still, for the most part, unless they had this defect, and they were pinkish in colour because of the Pinot Noir grapes. One thing that Dom Perignon did was he basically said no more trampling, which sounds quite like a bit of a sanitary progressive for 1693. He brought around this idea of doing multiple pressings. So your first pressing was like so light and gentle that the skin wouldn't even be broken and wouldn't go into the liquid, so you could make white colored wine from red grapes, and that was like the end goal. And the reason that for the carbonation was that it was cooler in Champagne than in lots of other wine growing regions, so when the weather got cold, the wine would stop fermenting, and then when it warmed up again, it would ferment, but it was already in the bottles, so then you'd get this carbonation. And yeah, that was seen as something they wanted to get rid of.
And I think even in listening to that bit of the story, I agree with you, Ollie, that it does get sort of boring and technical, particularly
when
you start to...
Jesus Christ!
You did your very best with it, and you actually did a much better job than I was doing.
But can we go back to me mansplaining the ingredients of our
No, 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 but I think that the point that you're making about why you need a bit of a sexy story to hang around the invention of champagne, that's kind of like, it's what we're arriving at here, that anytime you do try to talk about the centuries of progress and everything that went into it, it does get a bit kind of dull. But actually, you know, if you could create this sort of fanciful moment where a particular guy had this sort of, you know, quite poetic experience of drinking this lovely, lovely stuff, then yeah, it captures the imagination.
Okay, so let's briefly give the counter narrative, which is that there are some Spanish dudes who were also into this at the time, and there was an English guy called Christopher Merritt who documented in 1662, so a couple of decades before this, that, quote, "Wine coopers of recent times use vast quantities of sugar and molasses to all sorts of wines to make them drink brisk and sparkling and to give them spirit. And that is now believed to be the first time anyone had applied the word sparkling to wine, and it was an Englishman. It wasn't Dom Perignon. But what I find more interesting is why it was Dom Perignon that's the story that took off. And there's a whole book about this by a historian called Joan de Jean, which is all about how effectively Louis XIV created the idea of French luxury that we're still buying now. Not just champagne, but also perfume and cheese and all the things that we think of as posh are basically Louis XIV's tastes. And it's a bit like we were talking about last week with Elizabeth I being the ultimate influencer on tobacco. It doesn't matter who tried it before Elizabeth I did. She did, and then everyone wanted it in English high society. Louis XIV liked champagne, just like he liked gold leaf and diamonds and expensive hairdos. And as a result, so did posh French society. And as a result, the whole world still thinks, because we haven't really moved on from his tastes, still thinks of it as a luxury tipple.
Well, I can't help but think that that may be the reason that the British embraced the sparkling champagne in the first place, that we didn't realise that it was basically the unwanted bottles, and the French were probably just, you know, raking it in, thinking, yeah, ship them all off to the UK. But obviously the problem was that because of this exploding bottle issue, until they developed stronger glass, which is like in the mid-19th century, they couldn't really mass produce fizzy champagne. So it did remain the preserve of an elite handful of early adopters until then.
And it was in England, as you say, that it was particularly being driven in taste terms. Some scholars think that that was connected to the popularity of beer in England. And because people already were into kind of carbonated fizzy beverages, they could get into a fizzy version of wine. And it was particularly popular in the English court. But I think that, yeah, the French did sense this opportunity and they were like, okay, well, let's try to really manufacture this stuff big time.
If people in England were really drinking champagne at all, because fraudsters got into this act pretty quickly, didn't they, to create fake champagne, because people hadn't tasted it. It's like a drug dealer now cutting up ketamine and mixing it with talcum powder or whatever they do. You know, you get the waiter to pour the champagne from a height and it would come out a bit bubblier. And it wasn't really champagne at all. And if you shook it, you know, before popping the cork, then that would make it all froth out as well, even some old bottle of wine.
Yeah, and that actually caused a lot of problems for the producers in champagne because there weren't really a lot of rules and regulations around stuff like, you know, trademarks or products of controlled origin, that kind of thing in those days. And then it was compounded by... Champagne was part of the Western Front in World War One, so loads of vineyards are basically just bombed into oblivion. But that actually proved to be the turnaround, because that's when the French government started passing all these strict laws to protect the champagne's sort of trademark, which gradually, you know, helped the industry to recover. Because before then, people were drinking, like, you know, fizzy rhubarb juice.
By the way, I have seen blogs saying you can put white wine in a soda stream if you want a budget version. apparently it worked. The person who was writing about it, she said the best way to do it the first time you do it is do it in the bathroom, just in case it will go terribly wrong.
Are they the same blogs that say that you can cut your ketamine with talcum powder to make it go further? But after the Second World War, it's amazing how champagne has really come to be that thing that you're talking about, Ollie, the drink of celebration. After 1950, sales of champagne have quadrupled around the world to a stage that now they're producing 200 million bottles of champagne and selling them worldwide every year. It's an astonishing success story.
I was actually lucky enough to go on a press trip to Epernay, the French town that's kind of the epicenter of the champagne industry. And they were telling us that the big markets now are Russia, Brazil, China, and they've basically brought in new things. Like they were showing us like this Moet ice that's meant to be drunk in warmer climates, like for instance Brazil or India, and you are meant to put ice in it. So it is continuing to evolve, but it's still this icon of privilege. I mean, that's the weird thing about it, is that it has a whole cultural resonance that's completely separate from the fact that it is a sparkling wine. You know, we talk about champagne socialists. Apparently there was a craze in Victorian times for men to shine their shoes with champagne that was started by the famous dandy Beau Brummel.
Just one weird little factoid. Apparently, the amount of pressure in a champagne bottle is around 3 times the amount of pressure in your average car tire. And it's because of this that there's a really staggering amount of champagne bottle-related injuries and deaths. Apparently, 24 people die every year from champagne-related accidents, mostly at weddings. So stand back. Seriously, stand back when people are opening the champagne at
is that the cork the next wedding going into someone's vein or something?
Straight into their vein. It must be about, you know, hitting Aunt Maud in the head and then she falls over on the sharp bit of the table and, you know, the end. So, but yeah, 24 people every year apparently die in such happy yet sad circumstances.
Well, that is sobering, isn't it? Do you carry on with the event? I don't know what you do if someone dies of a champagne-related incident.
Yeah, good question.
I think you probably do, don't you? I mean, if not, if it's the bride.
Tomorrow.
The election of FDR is so ruinous that it literally kills Daddy Warbucks.
Love the show? Support the show. Patreon.com/retrospectors. Part of the Acast Creator Network.